Gallagher's gonna have the news.
Monday, July 15th. This is LA Podcast. I'm Scott Frazier. We've got Hayes Davenport and Alyssa Walker here as well. A lot to talk about.
A lot to talk about. And no headphones today. Podcasting without a net.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of like the flying Walendas.
Yes. So give us feedback to let us know if you can hear the show.
That's our favorite kind of feedback. Yeah. The quality stuff is not something we actively seek out.
There is a lot to talk about this week. Does anyone have an LA story to share with the group?
I guess I have one. My LA story is continuing in a theme in recent weeks. I managed to continue being extremely online to my detriment.
Okay.
To my extreme detriment. When I ventured
summer.
In when I decided to make a rare venture into the tepid swamp that is housing Twitter. Ugh. And say that a lot of the discourse around pro-housing groups is appropriated from other social justice movements. This, which I felt like I broached in a relatively respectful and tame style, because a lot of these people that are active in this space are friends of mine and people who I respect intellectually, etc., got a lot of negative attention. And so I spent like the entire day, whatever day that was, like Thursday this week, basically having my phone blow up.
What did you say?
People tell me that I was an idiot.
This was while I was gone.
Yeah, it was. I notably absent from my defense. Thanks.
What did you do? What? I mean, maybe I wouldn't have. Maybe I'm glad I was gone.
What did I say? There was a tweet from some, I don't even care, meeting in San Francisco where somebody had a button, Sonia Trauss of YIMBY, et cetera, in San Francisco, had posted something on Twitter that said that she was wearing a button that had like the rainbow building, like skyline, and legalized housing, I think was the message. And somebody had come up to her at this meeting and said that this was appropriation. And so that popped up in my feed. I don't know why.
It was like
reason.
A pride version of a button that they have called legalized housing.
Right.
Was that why? Because there's two messages here that I think that you were talking about, the legalized and then also.
Well, I was actually talking more generally overall. I just happened to like see this tweet. So I actually had thought, like, I've seen in the past a lot of messages come out of people that I know are part of this discourse that are 100%. Appropriated from particularly Black social justice movements. So I clicked on the tweet and I like scrolled down and it's a bunch of, you know, presumably affiliated people saying like, LOL, it's stupid that anyone would accuse us of appropriating anything. And I was like, well, regardless of whatever you might think of this particular button, that is something that happens in these spaces a lot. And it's, Hayes, you and I met at an abundant housing thing.
We did.
So like this is a space I've been in and around for several years at this point. It's something I've seen personally on numerous occasions. So I made the comment that pro-housing supply groups do use appropriated rhetoric. And I don't think it's an isolated thing. And I don't think it's something that should be laughed off, basically. And the response to that was basically a lot of people coming into my mentions and telling me that I was asinine, or that like, it showed how like people of color are so quick to jump on presumably people who are acting in their best interest or whatever. My original statement was just, I find it off-putting that people would do this, especially for a cause that I think has some valid basis on which to stand on its own. And my the culmination, I suppose, of this day spent on Twitter, other than a massive, very stressful, panic-filled evening for myself, was, oh wow, like actually, not that appropriation doesn't happen, it does, and it is still a problem, but it is probably insignificant compared to the problem that is outright hostility to any kind of call for self-reflection, no matter how gently it is put to them. So it was rough.
Man.
It wasn't fun. And then I was just kind of like, why do I ever do this? I don't.
That sucks. Yeah. I'm sorry that happened to you. What?
It's okay.
The only sympathy I have for them up there is politics up there are so factionalized. People that agree on 95% of policy spend all day having the least productive argument over the other 5%. It's all tied to politicians up there, too. Whereas down here, we have basically no one to root for, about like right. no one to like attach our hopes and dreams to.
Yeah.
They have politicians who are forced to like represent all of their views.
Yeah.
And so everything is tied up in like point scoring for these different teams. And as a result, all these groups are simultaneously on the offensive and defensive at any given time. So you, just trying to make an observation, have nothing tied up in this.
Nothing whatsoever.
Like no allegiance that you need to like prove or not. Like wade into it, and it just becomes like another like volley in this like back and forth war,
which I find the least interesting war of all time, and I would welcome them out of my mentions at any point.
I did that last night. Finally, it just takes up way too much of. I mean, of like how much I'm hearing about certain supervisors and the Soma plan from 5 years ago or whatever, just like still being litigated.
You remove certain terms from your searches, or
people,
how did you?
And lots of people who I really like personally.
You went on a mute. You went on a mute.
Yes.
Mute rampage.
Just like so freeing.
Kind of have to do it. Yeah.
Well, we should focus on our own city as a good argument. I mean, I feel like sometimes I am. Especially dealing with like safe streets stuff happening in other cities. And it's very emotionally consuming. And sometimes I'm like, I wish I could maybe not hear about every cyclist and pedestrian death that happened over the weekend when I sign in on Monday to Twitter.
And I have to say, when I do wade into this, as you said, like the impetus that I have is, like I said, there are a lot of people involved in this work that I know personally and respect. And so when I make a call for that kind of activism to be better, which is really all I'm doing. I'm not like I ended up having to be like, you know, people are acting like by saying you're appropriating rhetoric from other movements that like appropriation is some kind of crime that carries like a death penalty or something like that. There's such a knee-jerk reaction to it.
All you say, especially when someone points out something to you, all you say is, wow, thanks for telling me. I'll look at that or I'll think about it.
It's easy to just say that, right?
It's the only thing you have to do.
At a minimum. But like when I say that with the expectation that this kind of activism can happen in a better and more productive manner, my real ties to it are to the people in LA. So whether or not people in San Francisco think that that is a reasonable standard to which to hold themselves or for other people to hold them to, it's kind of neither here nor there. This is LA podcast, not California podcast. And I don't really care what they do with it.
Yeah, I have a certain amount of jealousy of the discourse up there because it is just so active and people are so engaged. I wish I could hear people going at it about this stuff in LA, on specific stuff in LA. More of, you know, probably be careful what I wish for. Watch for like a month from now, something like blows up and just ruins all of our lives. But yeah, it's just I'm out for at least a little while. Sorry, everyone up there. Alyssa, what's going on for you?
Well, I just wanted to follow up on our conversation we had before the little one. Maybe we can call it the earthquake. Like two weeks ago. But we were talking about how important it is to be very online for causes we care about. And we're going to talk about bus lanes a little bit more in the show. But I was happy to see, we had a conversation about, should we do like a coordinated tweet storm on a certain day? Should we be reminding our electeds that we want dedicated lanes for transportation methods that are not destructive to lives or, you know, the planet? And I really like the idea that someone came up with that exists, that's out there already, Transit Tuesdays. So maybe we can all get together on Transit Tuesdays and do some organizing online.
I like Transit Tuesdays.
And reminding people. And I also wanted to give a shout out to the Los Angeles County Bicycle Coalition, which is having a forum, which I love the name of, Which Way LA CBC, RIP Which Way LA, on Saturday, July 27th from 11 to 3 at their office. And you can look online to find it. But they put this amazing thread up. That's like, there's 15 reasons why we don't have dedicated bike infrastructure, and I'll add bus infrastructure to that as well, and really encouraging people to stop going after like DOT or other organizations.
Those 15 reasons being...
I can't imagine what those 15 reasons could be. I mean,
you were the first person I saw to say that exact phrase.
Yeah,
they kind of cop that from me.
Each of the 15 members of the city council.
No, that's okay. That's good. It's good to spread the message.
Yeah.
But I like that they were really pointing out that there's one way we can get this done, and there's 15 parts of that way. And go to this forum, and on Tuesday, let's all try to remind everybody that this is how we get this done. So
I love it. Let's go right into some of the bus lane stuff. I'll use my LA story for that. I wasn't here for this, but I feel like I was.
Yeah, I felt like I was like sweating. It was like 90 degrees in my backyard, and I was like with my kids, like trying to keep them entertained. I was like, leave me alone.
Just
I'm looking at Twitter.
Yeah. Right.
At Topo Modesto, who is one of the founders of Bike the Vote, was at this bus rapid transit meeting in Eagle Rock. Eagle Rock, an interesting neighborhood that I don't feel like we've talked about quite enough on this show.
Well, you don't have to, because it's just a small suburban
community,
tight knit. You know, they've got everything figured out.
Yes.
But there's two things to know about this meeting going into it. One is it was at, well, okay. There's been several meetings that we've talked about as part of this. We've been talking about another BRT project, and now this is the other major BRT project that also needs to be done. These are meetings that are occurring from North Hollywood to Pasadena. And one thing that just like kind of tweaked me at the beginning of this process was, if you signed up for alerts for this particular project, an email went out earlier in the week with only free parking information for all the meetings that are coming up. First of all, red flag.
But they did change it because of you.
They did change it, and they did, you know, say that they were working on fixing that. But still, yeah. The email went out. Who was reading that email? Who decided that only free parking is what we know?
Yeah.
That leads us into who was there.
Yes. The initial photos from the thread suggested that most of the attendants were tending towards the senior side and much whiter than the actual community. So,
Eagle Rock is like two thirds either Asian or Latinx.
Eagle Rock is extremely diverse. It's
plus being college students, again, Occidental College, right, who are not there in the summer when these meetings are happening.
Yes.
Again,
yeah.
People
yes.
who need to yeah. get to school.
Eagle Rock, according to the last numbers that have come out, it was 40% Latinx, 29.8% white, 23% Asian, 1.8% black, and 4.1% other. Compare that to, I think, Scott, you posted this a while ago, a flyer advertising like the initial Eagle Rock development right after it became a part of LA. Let me read this and maybe we can put some like suburban ad music behind it. The advantageous location of Eagle Rock is unexcelled. Eagle Rock is a corporate part of the great city of Los Angeles. Our hills and dales provide the most favored of view home sites. Eagle Rock is 400 feet higher than 7th and Broadway, out of fogs. Favorable restrictions help create a community of beautiful homes. The residents of Eagle Rock are all of the white or Caucasian race.
Yep.
With prices now low, property values promise substantial increase. So if you noticed it there...
there was one thing that maybe stood out from the other qualities. That was actually, I believe that was John Gordon of Metro who posted that flyer. But this is something where every time we talk about the historically small town character of a specific neighborhood, yeah, it should probably be brought into context that the history of racially restricted covenants is still written all over this region. It's really evident in places like Eagle Rock and elsewhere.
Yes, but it was mostly white meeting in terms of the attendance there. But the comments were actually pretty mixed. According to, you got to, following this thread, you got to follow just like the back and forth of like who was supporting and who wasn't. There were some really great ones. I think one of the first people, the first person who spoke represented the Eagle Rock 411 website, which is anti bus rapid transit.
So what does 411 mean? Why is it? I could not figure this
out. It's like a smaller town 911.
But like what is 4? it's like 4.5.
It's a down zoned.
But what does 411 mean?
Like information.
But like Eagle Rock, is it like existing website or they made it just for this?
I think, we're running out of domains for, they'll just have to buy them from each other.
All right. I didn't know if it was like an existing site. I couldn't really tell.
They said, so did a bunch of other people, that they are prepared to litigate, which is not going to be hard to do under CEQA law if the bus rapid transit go through. But then the next one was a 69 year resident of Eagle Rock speaks up to say he supports BRT on Colorado Boulevard, which he would personally use and which would help other residents and students get to and from our community. You read stuff like that, like stakeholders, like residents of this neighborhood.
You bought in, you're into the
Yeah, I did buy it. Because then, well, then the next guy got up and said he hates the word stakeholder. If you buy a cup of coffee, you're not more important than homeowners, right. He says, of people in the in that community.
If pressed, I'm sure he would also say, if you rent in that neighborhood, you're not as important as homeowners. I mean,
that is less important. And on the scale, it goes coffee, working in the neighborhood, renting in the neighborhood for your entire life because you can't afford a home, and buying a home.
But the 411 people, whoever they are, they want the route to go instead on the 134 freeway and have stops on the freeway. This is what I like, like the way that like the Green Line or the Gold Line nearby has like stops, Silver Line, sorry. They want the line to go on the 134 freeway and have stops like the Silver Line has, or like nearby the Gold Line rail has in Pasadena, and not come through Colorado Boulevard because it would ruin the small town character that was created by the original streetcars that served the area. So what are they thinking? I mean, how, where, what, why?
A good journalist. Those are the five.
Their plan is like to do that. But do they not know that the buses already run down Colorado Boulevard? Are they not aware that like a rapid bus travels in the same area every day?
So this is the confusing thing. They say like, if we get bus rapid transit along this corridor, we'll be able to be upzoned under these new rules like SB 50.
Which would already be, this was all very confusing to me. Are they that clueless about what
also
buses?
All the stuff about ripping out medians and like getting rid of trees and stuff.
I guess so. They don't want the stops to be on the historic medians. That's the biggest thing. They don't want the stations, the BRT stations.
Proxy arguments.
I'm just really trying to figure this out.
I don't believe that the way that Metro plans it, there actually would be stops on the freeway. I think it would just completely bypass the area.
It would just not stop.
Mm-hmm. Similar to the, what is that, 534 or whatever the current very low ridership route is that they have going to and from North Hollywood and Pasadena does make very few stops.
So it would be less localized.
It would, like you said, completely remove the ability for that route to serve the students at Occidental. And generally, like Hayes is saying, these are all just arguments.
So it was like, keep Metro off Colorado Boulevard. But I was like, do they really not know that Metro is already on Colorado Boulevard? That their shirts that they were wearing, that's what they said.
And they had the little bus with the...
I was just like, I will ride the rapid bus to these people's houses and be like, I got here on the bus. I regret to inform you, Metro is already on Colorado Boulevard.
No, they're afraid that it would work. They're afraid that it would be like an influx of people that it would make these areas more accessible. This woman got up next and said, we don't want to ride the buses. They're dirty and they're unsafe.
Right.
Which is saying that the people that ride the buses are dirty and unsafe. Yep. I mean, it's not a huge leap to get there.
And most of these people are the same ones who would say, and somebody else who got up to speak did say, you're not getting us out of our cars. Yes. This notion that nobody does, like, not nobody walks in LA, but nobody doesn't drive in LA. And like, the buses are empty. The bike lanes are empty.
Empty. And they played that Metro video that I love that says, and you know, we are not car culture. And they booed the video. They booed the uplifting vision of LA's future that
they
Metro
booed a lot.
Had created.
But these are just, I mean, like fundamentally, these are grumpy old shits. Like,
we can't discount that because there was some other, a great tweet thread that I saw from Hippie Runner.
At Hippie Runner.
Amazing. And she was like, you know, this is a toxic environment. I was so afraid to get up there because I knew I was going to get booed. I did it anyway. This is harassment.
Yeah.
And Metro needs to treat it that way.
But the person who did this thread concluded by saying that after his comments, he was told that he was going to be sued by a resident of Eagle Rock.
Topo Modesto. Not a Hippie Runner, but the other. And I think like that is, I mean, I've had the same thing happen to me at meetings, right? And Hayes has seen it.
I was scared for my life. That wasn't even like
a public meeting. That was just like a fun event.
Supposed to be.
I've been booed and called all sorts of things. And when it is being organized by Metro or the City of LA or whatever group, those people need to be isolated and kicked out. Like, you cannot create that kind of environment. You cannot, like, have people screaming in your face
Yeah.
And it's always people who should really know better. It's not, it's people who have, like, what are these people telling their kids that they're going to do that day? I'm going to this meeting to, like, scream at someone and boo at videos and loudly hiss when people are talking and tell people I'm going to sue them.
I mean, like, so the basic, I feel like I've been fairly critical of this project in the past and probably will continue to be because it's kind of whatever from a transit ridership perspective. But I mean, the ultimate bottom line is that bus lanes are something that we need. Like, the flowchart is basically a bus lane on this LA Boulevard. Does it have buses on it? Yes, then yes. No, then, you know, maybe we should add buses and then go back to the beginning. But yeah, so we need this here and elsewhere. And the fact that this is such a fight is indicative of how hard this is going to be to do anywhere. So yeah, I think it's great that so many people turned out to support the bus lanes. This is the kind of thing that without a serious effort to marshal people to actually, you know, not just say online that they were in support of it, but to actually physically show up, you could see how this would have been a catastrophe for this project if there were not people who were lined up to speak in favor of it.
Look at the local news coverage of it, not ours, which will be out on Monday, but the headlines are like hundreds show up with concerns about that's not accurate in any way. And even if you read the stories, you'll hear, and I think that most people will agree, that it was like, seemed like it was well represented from either side, and there were good arguments from either side, and there were things said from either side. But like, you, the headline is not 100 people show up to express concerns. That's not true.
I mean, so I don't think that they should, and I don't think that they will make the decision about what to do here purely based on who shows up at a meeting like this. But I do think that if you have like 50-50 support or opposition, which it seems like that was pretty much what was reported, that's much different than having hundreds of people show up screaming, like basically violently angry about this bus lane, and having only like 10 or 20 people show up and be in favor of it. That's very different.
Yeah. They are having another meeting. They said they were going to have it at Oxy, I think, right? At a different time. Hopefully when more students,
because interest is so high.
And then there's other meetings coming up in the other places along the route. So check, you know, sign up for the email, ignore where it says free parking, and hopefully it will say bus lines next time you get there. But
I want to point out one comment that the same person who is called the buses dirty and unsafe said. This person was groaning and booing during the pro-transit speakers and said, they're all kids. There's no families.
Yeah, I loved that one.
This is a pretty constant theme of anti-transit, anti-bike people.
That housing.
Yes, that it's all like these young people who don't have like a stake in the community. I'm going to go the other way and say that their stake in the community is higher than yours.
Much greater.
Or do you think, why don't you think they have families yet?
Yes, that
because
is
they spend
your
all their
fault.
Money on right. their car and yes. their apartment.
So I highly recommend this thread. We actually tweeted it out on the podcast account. Let's talk about someone that we haven't, is a huge presence in LA, has sort of been laying in the cut for the last year that we did this, this podcast. A guy named Brian Darcy. Brian Darcy is the president of the Union of Workers for the Department of Water and Power, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. And he has had an adversarial relationship with Mayor Garcetti. The two of them have had this rivalry since before Garcetti came into office, since Garcetti's campaign for mayor in 2013.
When he was a bit more critical of, in particular, the DWP and the union that represents most of its workers, and Wendy Gruel was seen as more favorable to them.
Yes, he was running opponent. Against a woman named Wendy Gruel, who is also a former council member. Who was seen as more of a union-friendly candidate and got something like $40 million. Is it possible that it was that much? She got a lot of money from...
Sounds like a lot.
That maybe it was four. Don't check my numbers on that. But it got a huge amount of money from the DWP union and did end up losing. So this week... You might have seen some ads on TV if you're watching like the local news or whatever, some ads criticizing Garcetti on homelessness, but that were really about Garcetti's Green New Deal proposal. Let's play the ad for people.
Homelessness is nearly up 50% in your city since you became mayor, according to the LA Times.
This is what people say is an unsolvable problem, and I'm committed to solving it.
Remember when Eric Garcetti pledged to end homelessness in LA? $1 billion of our tax dollars spent, and the crisis is worse than ever. Now he wants green taxes on LA drivers and utility rate hikes on local families. Let's pump the brakes on Garcetti's new taxes. The only thing green will be money coming out of our wallets.
So I agree with maybe the first 15 seconds of this ad. And it does bug me when he talks about how this is an unsolvable problem, but I am going to solve it. That's saying like, well, if I don't, it is unsolvable, which it's not. Homelessness is a very solvable problem. That said, this ad is not about homelessness.
No.
That is another proxy argument to work its way into your heart. It has nothing to do with the homelessness issue.
And there's been banner ads on news sites that you've probably seen that are like this and other variations on it going to the same. I was just trying to find one, but they always it's so hard to find.
The basis of the argument is basically that what the union is trying to say, or what the DWP, I guess, is trying to say, some affiliates of it, is that Garcetti is making these promises in exchange for like taxpayers offering up large amounts of money, but can he be trusted to deliver on what he's offering? They're making an argument, like you're saying, a proxy argument for what they really want, which we'll get to in a second. But the basis of the argument is you're going to give money and get nothing in return from this administration.
Yes. Here's what it's really about. We talked earlier this year about when Garcetti and the city council issued their plan to close 3 DWP plants powered by natural gas. The Scattergood plan, El Segundo, and 2 others over the next decade. And some had already been decommissioned, and they're just not going to bring them back online, basically.
Right.
This is going to cost the DWP some jobs. I think they estimate like 400 jobs or something like that. That's what they're upset about. They want to get these plants up and running. Brian Darcy, the head of the union, said back in April, he called the plan pie in the sky nonsense and said it's so blatantly political. All he wants to do is sign the Green New Deal so he can be along with the left wing of the Democratic Party. So no mention of climate change and right. reducing carbon emissions or anything like that. Brian Darcy, really interesting guy, has been the head of the DWP union forever, for decades at this point, basically. Basically, his role in LA city politics is so big because they spend a ton of money on campaigns. It was actually $4 million, not $40 million that he spent on Wendy Gruel. They have 9,000 members. They really get them out to canvas and everything like that. They have millions of dollars to spend. And in a low turnout election environment, that makes a huge, huge difference. Right now, they're supporting John Lee up in Council District 12 for the special election that we endorsed Lorraine Lundquist for, because she is an environmental scientist who wants to decrease carbon emissions in LA. And this DWP union sees that as kind of a threat. So we end up in this environment where this very politically influential union has taken a position basically against cleaning up the way that we use energy in the city in order to maintain jobs and keep their members happy.
Yeah, I mean, this is such an interesting one because, like, as you mentioned at the top, Brian Darcy, he's been in this position for a long time, and he does not like Garcetti. Garcetti kind of has, over the course of his time in office, been forced to capitulate to a number of the requests of the union against his will, resulting in the IBEU local chapter having significantly better contract deals than most of the unions over the same time. Of course, Garcetti came into office during the aftermath of the Great Recession, and a big focus locally and at the state level was scaling back some benefits and sort of like bringing to heel what was seen as the excessive power of unions, particularly in relationship to the way that the city is run. As you're listening to this, you may remember the LA 2020 Commission, or you may not. It's kind of one of these things that we trot out. And
I barely do.
Do literally none of the recommendations from. But this was an effort in 2014, shortly after Garcetti took office, that was intended to figure out how we were going to achieve some kind of sustainable job and wage growth in the Southern California region by 2020. one of their recommendations was to rein in the DWP in general, which is a public utility. It's a pretty strangely run organization administratively. The mayor appoints the commissioners, as he does to many other public agencies, but there's also a level of oversight that comes from city council and even a variety of other places. It's kind of a mess. And so the LA 2020 commission was recommending that there needs to be some sort of thorough overhaul of that. Garcetti originally backed that, but then kind of backed away from it after he kind of got shellacked during the contract negotiations with the DWP union. That was kind of the initial black eye that he got in his administration. So it's the continuation of a relationship that has been adversarial from the start, even before he took office. I wonder how much of that is leading to this position of a really hard line against the LA Green New Deal, which is not, we've talked about it on the show. It's not like extraordinarily ambitious, right? It's steps that pretty much anybody of any stripe of the Democratic Party would agree is necessary for us to take in the very near future, which leads to Brian Darcy saying, my members might stop being Democrats if we pursue this, which I think is problematic. That's a problematic approach to this issue. I think that we've seen other unions be a lot more open to the fact that we need to change the way that we do some things fundamentally locally.
And yeah, there's been at the national level, I just wrote about this through the presidential election lens about climate change and how, you know, the AFL-CIO came out and said, well, we can't quite support the Green New Deal, but they were still trying to work on it. But then SEIU, which is a very big service workers union, they have endorsed the Green New Deal. And particularly in LA, they have said that we're on board. So unions, I think, are trying to work through it and get to the point where they know they can, you know, at least have conversations about it. And I think that that is something we're seeing at the national level that could, you know, you might see more of it happening here in LA, but also against the backdrop of what happened in the last week, yesterday particularly, we had a huge blackout in New York City. We had the entirety of Midtown Manhattan go dark for not that long, but you know, it's another question about our utilities and how resilient are we going to be. And then you have, looking up north here, PG&E is now going to charge this fee back to the ratepayers to make sure that we have like insurance money in case something else goes wrong when it comes to wildfires. And this is both of these things, you know, they're related, and we're going to confront some of the same issues very quickly. And our water and power is together two big problems that we have.
Yeah, I mean, and so Darcy's saying, I think that the argument that Darcy is making, that this is what keeps power on in people's houses, and it doesn't make sense to attack this.
And rates low is what they really emphasize, is that our rates are still not that high compared to other places.
Is not a compelling argument to me.
I'm sorry,
the future of humanity.
Even compared to, you know, what is in the plan is basically, it's not a plan unless it involves the replacement of these power sources and, you know, in a way that is sustainable going forward. So it's kind of just a restatement of what we already know is the purpose for doing this in the first place. I wonder really how much of this is because Darcy has had so much success against Garcetti and City Hall, how much of this is just positioning for whatever they would like to get out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it has worked in the past. The reason I'm kind of sympathetic to the union's position is Darcy is like an old fashioned, like bare knuckle, shot in a beer type of union boss.
Yep.
And the IBEW, the Union of DWP Workers, is a pretty averagely paid union. But like all the criticisms about they get these amazing like sweet deals are kind of overblown. They don't pay anything into their healthcare premiums, which must be nice.
Yep.
But like in general, the raises are pretty much on average compared to other places. And there's 9,000. He's got to look out for his workers. Yep. I'm part of an increasingly aggressive union, and I like it. I like that my union is fighting for me. At the same time, if we had an actual Green New Deal, the IBEW would have to be a huge part of it.
Right. I mean, they should be benefiting from it. Yes, of course.
If we are really going to expand our renewable infrastructure, the IBEW would be able to expand its membership.
We could be doing so much more already to do that.
That's kind of what we've talked about in the past as far as so we've talked both about the prospective national Green New Deal, and we've talked a bit more recently about the LA Green New Deal, but But when we invoke this term of the New Deal program, the New Deal is a labor program. Yeah. It is fundamentally a labor program. So
that's what the reason these guys are all Democrats now is because of that original New Deal.
Exactly. So really, is there a way to enact programs like this in a way that is more favorable to labor? Probably. Like, you want the support of labor in order to do these kind of things, whether that's job retraining, job safety, etc. But the whole purpose is that there's going to be a lot of work to be done. That is the
and
way.
Also, we need to be. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh no, that's okay. I was just going to say that's the purpose of framing it this way in terms of the national Green New Deal. With the LA Green New Deal, it is a bit more, I would say, questionable about what the labor component is because it's so much more scaled down.
And
so,
this is what we need to start seeing. Again, this is what I said from the beginning. How many months ago was that? This April? I don't know.
Yeah, April.
We should be seeing signs going up and branding and like, this project brought to you by the Green New Deal, or this was something that was in or some kind of scoreboard or something. We need to start knowing that we're working together as a city towards these goals, and we need to start seeing the benefits that it's creating for our lives. And then everybody will probably be a lot more in favor of the changes that we need to make.
Do you know what Gene Mattis, the former LA Weekly writer at all? He used to cover Brian Darcy. And whenever he showed up to the office, Brian Darcy would come downstairs with a baseball bat to chase him off the property and then give him the finger through his office window.
That's the kind of journalism we need
on his way out. Yeah. Let's talk about these new Airbnb laws. Alyssa, you wrote an article about this. These went into practice a few weeks ago, but we haven't gotten into it yet.
It's very interesting. So if you are a host for Airbnb or any... They're called home sharing rules or something like that, right? So it's the city's planning department. It's their way of regulating people who want to rent out parts of their home, vacation rentals, all these sorts of things. Responding to criticism, I think, from certain parts of the city where people are worried that these short-term rentals are taking up housing units that could be used for people. And we've seen it all. We've seen these right down on Sunset. There's all those little bungalows as you're heading down towards Dodger Stadium.
Yeah.
And there's some of these entire bungalow courts that are bought up by these short-term rental companies, and they're just renting them out like little cute little pied-à-terres for a couple weeks, or somebody coming from New York that wants to like try out living in LA before they move here. It's very specifically branded. So, and then at the same time too, the argument from some people who rent out their houses or their rooms in their houses is that they use it to make money so they can stay in their places where they live. And it's a good way to say, if you're not going to be around for a few weeks, to let someone rent a home. So there's quite rigid rules. And I would say, like, of any big city, these are very, very stringent rules that are being passed here in LA.
Going to place,
and they went into effect July 1st, but they're not going to be enforcing them until November 1st. So I guess you're fine until November 1st. I don't really know. Like, I'm just reporting what they told me. But you have to pay a fee up front. You have to register your property. And the biggest thing I think that is striking is that you can only have one property registered with the city. So all these people who have maybe multiple vacation rentals, or we're just buying apartments or condos or whatever just to rent them out, like, I don't know what happens at this point for those people.
Yeah, like, and if they have like a building, is that that's one property?
They have to.
That's one unit.
That's one unit. One unit is the unit. It's where you have to live. It has
you
to
have
be
to
your
live in it for at least 6 months
residence.
Out of the year.
Yeah. So this is like a very tricky thing for a lot of people who have maybe set up their livelihoods around this. There are a lot of people I know that do these, not personally, but like, there's people who like have these vacation rentals and they've put them on Instagram and do these things that get people to stay there. So now you're going to have to pay money to register them. You're going to have
registration fee. They already had you were already responsible to pay taxes on these, right?
I think the taxing is different from what the city is talking about. But yes, I mean, there's all sorts of, however you do your taxes, there's, I think you have to worry about that. But I think this is going to create, my first reaction was, there's not going to be a black market for vacation rentals.
There already sort of is.
There already is.
So down near where I live, there's one place that has a sign outside that says, this is not a vacation rental. If you got sent here by a website, you got scammed. But that itself is a lie. Yeah. Like they, it is a vacation.
So
rental.
I think what I've been seeing since this got passed, and it's good for the city, I suppose, to try to at least know how many units this is affecting and if it is truly cutting into the affordable housing stock for the city. I guess it's a good way to try to index these things. But I also, I guess we will know more in November when they actually start cracking down and they have the numbers of who's being registered and how much, you know, how many units people have or what the impact on neighborhoods. But all I can see is that a lot of people just post their thing on Instagram or send it to friends and be like, come just book it directly through me.
There's the guy that's a victim of waves.
Yeah.
Right?
He's a landlord.
He's out of business. He's an actual landlord, which these people now should probably become. Right. Like, just rent it out.
These are effective already, right? As of the start
technically
of the,
July 1st. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I do wonder, so when we're saying that this is going to lead to a black market for short-term rentals, that is essentially what Airbnb was, basically. Yes. I mean, before being regulated, it was black market hotel rooms, more or less. It was wide open for anybody to see it, but still it existed in kind of a place where it was not explicitly legal. One of the things that is in here is that none of the registered units can be RSO units, which is 75% of the rental units in the city, of course.
Even if you own it and have permission from whoever owns it,
which is interesting. I think that I'm of two minds on this, because in the first place, you think about the types of people who are looking to make a little bit of extra money in these types of sharing economy, gig economy, whatever you want to call it, manners. You have a lot of people who just need supplemental income to get by, who might be in a rent stabilized unit and are now effectively locked out of this. You also do, of course, have a number of people who, like you were talking about, Alyssa, are essentially just buying up buildings so that they can convert them into short-term rental units. That being said, the RSO, the Rent Stabilization Ordinance, puts down pretty strict laws, pretty strict rules about what rent can be set and how rent can be set for a unit in such a way that you kind of do wonder if it is even possible to do a short-term rental like this in a way that wouldn't fall afoul of the RSO rules. So I think that kind of makes some amount of sense to me, although certainly tenants are losing out if they wanted to participate in this.
Right.
I think the other interesting thing that this brings up is the question about hotel rooms is always being brought before the city council, right? So it's always like, we need more hotel rooms. Well, we actually might need more hotel rooms if this is going to be a super restrictive policy.
Right.
And if this carries forward all the way 9 years from now, it's almost Olympics time, right? I mean, you have to think about the kind of wheeling and dealing that's going to happen unless we change the rules and say you're allowed to let someone stay at your house and it's okay and like you don't have to pay anything. You know, we have to really look at like what we're trying to do. Tourism numbers, we talked about this before, through the roof. Every year more people are coming here. We want to make sure people have places to stay, but also hotels are kind of unfairly subsidized in a way that we are making it super easy to build hotels in all sorts of places, which could also cause negative impacts in our neighborhoods and to our housing stock. So I don't really know what the solution is here. I don't know which part is good or bad. Like you said, there's two things to look at, but I can't see. I'm very excited to see what happens in November when they have locked down the number of people who have registered and we can see these numbers and understand where this is happening and who are the people that are, you know, going to be impacted by this most.
I think that if you look at so you, Alyssa, put together the list of the things that are actually covered by these new rules, it's interesting because Airbnb has been very much under scrutiny for the past several years. It's taking them a long time to put these regulations together.
It took 3 years to get this together also.
And it's kind of interesting because the list of things that are in place now, it seems like it hews much more closely to, there are things in there for people who are concerned about like affordable housing, cost of housing, things like that. But there's also a lot of stuff that seems like it is specific to the complaints of possibly just like wealthy people who have quality of life complaints.
Party houses is in there. Like you have to adhere to these rules of, you know,
and that's why this is happening, right?
Curfews,
like for all the stuff about like adding affordable units, like it's because people are complaining about party houses and hotel companies like want more people to pay for hotels.
Sure. Yeah.
Again, me?
Back to Alyssa. You've had the righteous fury on your side all week on the case about the shake alert. And you got results.
I think I was vindicated.
The questions we were asking last week, all the bewilderment and the immediate aftermath of the little one.
Yep.
The little one.
You did actually answer some of them.
I think so. I think it was a good week for that concluded on Friday with a really good press conference, I thought, with the mayor talking about neighborhood preparedness. They have this new initiative called Ryland, which I think is a horrible name. And I'm not going to say it out loud, but it's like Ready Your Neighborhood something. Okay. LA neighborhood. Yeah. Anyway, I just feel like they could have come up with a snappier name. Anyway, it's this idea that you don't just make a kit and put it in your basement and then you just like climb into your basement and never come back out. It's the idea that you talk to your neighbors before the disaster happens and you find out who's a nurse, who has like a secret reservoir, yep, in their basement of water, right, of fresh water. And you actually try to get together and make a plan together, which I think is great. And there's also the CERT program, which you can become a certified emergency responder for your neighborhood. These are all things that we should be doing. So kind of tied into that, Lucy Jones, the now
celebrity,
super celebrity, yeah, seismologist, we knew her when, we talked with the mayor about what she would like to see as far as the alerts happening. So I got to talk to some great people at USGS. I got to talk to people at the mayor's office and just get a sense of what actually happened. And it turns out our hunches were correct. The USGS underestimated the second, right, earthquake, which can happen. But mm-hmm, I got to say, I haven't seen that happen that many times in all the stuff I've written about. There's always like, you know, they revise the magnitude several times after the earthquake happens. But the actual shake alert, the, right, shake alert data that came out right away was underestimated. So that's why we didn't get an alert. And we might have if they had, you know, actually known that it was going to be 7.1 right off the bat. But that's not LA's app's fault or anything like that. It's just like, so these things happen
based on the data that, yeah, they received.
And they said that it's very likely to happen on a southern San Andreas earthquake because of the, mm-hmm, way that it will rupture. It will go very far, you know, when it first ruptures.
Well, that speaks to what we said, you know, immediately after the second earthquake when we were recording last week's episode, which is that there seems like there was a serious design error in terms of where the threshold was set. We all said, I would say not from a perspective of being somebody who is interested in things going on in LA, but from a perspective of somebody who just like lives here, I would like to know when there's going to be an earthquake, you know, whether or not it's going to be strong or not. But certainly that is much more relevant to me than to have them say, well, the set is, you know, we're setting the threshold so high that it's only if it's going to be a calamitous event that, yes, you're going to get this notification.
So they confirm that they are, and again, I'm going to throw a bunch of numbers out. You're going to be like, what? But you're exactly right. Ignore these numbers. They said they were going to change the threshold for shaking intensity, which is going to different than magnitude. Shaking intensity is going to go from 4 to 3.
Right.
And then they'll also alert you for a little bit lower magnitude earthquake as well. I think the threshold was like 5 and now it's going to go to 4. But what you need to know, and the suggestion from Lucy Jones during this press conference, which was confirmed by the mayor, which I think is very, very smart, there'll be two different kinds of alerts. There will be an alert that says, hey, weak shaking is coming, just a heads up. I'm sure it'll say exactly that on the app when it comes through. And then the second one is damaging shaking is expected, get under something, yeah, or in Hayes's, you know,
crash
just
aside,
run outside, yeah, of the earth, yeah, whatever you want to run outside of a building and
in your life, one of the
your
other
life now
on your turf.
Because I think what she said was so smart. She said, you know, this wasn't damaging, but it was psychologically damaging, and it's so
Lucy,
true. Like,
just she gets me.
She gets. She understands. But like, I was with my kids. I knew that feeling, and the first thing that went in, you know, rippled through my own head was, God damn it. Like, I wish, right, I could have known, because like I scared my kids. I scared, you know, yeah, I was like, it was not the mom I wanted to be, yeah, at that moment. And having a little bit of heads up, hey guys, we're going to practice doing our
imagine
thing.
Like how cool you could be if you
well,
get a weak shaking alert.
No, but that's, I have in my house like a few times when I've had that other app, the beta tester for the Quake Alert app, the statewide one, yeah, which maybe it'll have the same kind of levels, but like I have announced in my house, like, hey guys.
Will your kids like touch your temple and be like, I'm sensing a disturbance.
I know that it's happening.
Gaia is speaking to you. She's
the
upset.
The best was later I told my daughter that there had been an aftershock, and she immediately was like, well, I'll just get under my bed now. And I was like, well, it's already happened. You missed it. Because there was like another one that morning of that press conference. But I do think that's a very smart idea. And I love that they had this public event on Facebook and on local news channels and just at least acknowledge that things need to change, and they will by the end of July, supposedly.
That's good.
I think to me, probably the most surprising thing about the whole shake alert stuff, other than the fact that nobody could seem to agree on the conditions under which it should have alerted.
Well, that's what happens when you don't have Lucy. She's busy talking to other people. I mean, she could have explained it in that moment. So I think it would have been okay.
It was that. And then one of the things that was surprising to me, I think after some pressure from you, Alyssa, they actually released the screenshot of what the app would look like if there was an alert for the first time. And it was like, earthquake, earthquake, stop, like, stop what you're doing and like, get under something.
That was, it was buried. It was hard to find that information.
I had never seen that screenshot before.
You would have not known that unless you had dug into the what is this app thing, right?
So to the point that people were making to me on Twitter immediately after the fifth quake, the medium one, the point that people were making to me was, I don't want to receive an alert that causes me to panic if it's not going to be damaging, which is a really simple fix. And the fix is that you don't only have one message.
Exactly. The ship sailed on that anyway. I got that Amber alert.
Well, right. That was the thing. People had the very, was it the day before the last after strike? It was maybe Thursday. There was an Amber alert. I didn't get it, so I don't know. But people are very attuned to knowing what that feels like. And
you don't get
and
Amber
what,
alerts?
No, I mean, I didn't get that
she
one.
She declined.
I didn't get that one because of the geofencing, right?
Okay,
I don't know.
Maybe.
Were you somewhere in that area?
I don't know.
I did not get one.
Oh, I got that. But yeah, it's very simple.
We know what that sounds like, and you know. Yeah.
Sure, but it's so simple to just like have more than one message because like for non-destructive shaking, I might still want an alert that says, you know, be prepared for moderate shaking or like light to no shaking. Probably don't want all caps earthquake, you know, drop what you're doing.
And some people had such great ideas. Just when I was asking on Twitter, like, what would you like to fix? And some people said, can I get multiple alerts? Like, is my mom's house shaking? Is my kid's school shaking? And also, like, can we make it go to our smart speakers or our Nest thermostats and have Alexa say, hey, you know, to the whole house, not just me on my phone, depending on when my phone is on or off. And then really smart ideas for using the air raid sirens that exist all over the city. And San Francisco has a public alert system. There's a lot of different ways we could get it out more publicly, especially for people who don't have smartphones or the most updated app, whatever. We can do this in a lot better ways.
Much better use of those air raid sirens than for preparing for nuclear war.
I mean, we have a different siren because, you know, the different sound because the threat is renewed.
Couple quick hits. FBI, who you may remember from the Jose Huizar investigation that is still apparently unresolved, our active city council member, is now investigating the LA Sheriff's Department, specific stations, for the existence of deputy gangs. We've talked about it, and Maya Lau's dogged coverage of this case for the LA Times since we started the podcast, basically. And now the FBI is on the case.
Yeah, they're after the banditos.
The banditos specifically.
What took them so long? This is not something that they would need to investigate sooner?
You know, it's interesting. I actually have no idea how they make the determination of which cases they want to allocate resources to.
They have a box that says fundraising, and that's how they were tipped.
I would imagine, though, that the prominence and preeminence of this story because of the investigations that have come out in the Times about this has been something that has, you know, and of course the intransigence of local officials from Lee Baca to Jim McDonald to now Alex Villanueva holding the sheriff's post to actually doing something about this issue is probably something that caused them to be more interested in digging into it.
Both the coverage and I don't think it's a big move to launch an investigation like this. And I don't think it's weird to suggest that there's a hint of some other behavior other than like just more aggressive policing that they are investigating, whether it's like participating in drug trafficking or like some other kind of acts by these gangs that they want to crack down on.
I would say there is an obvious culture of lawlessness that appears to be at work in the sheriff's department. Yeah. The FBI, of course, has, and I actually don't know if it was the FBI, maybe it was the DEA, but the federal law enforcement agencies have been in and around LA policing for a long time, notably with the crash scandal in the 90s. So the fact that they are back, you know, is, and also with the Lee Baca scandal, this is another black mark on how law enforcement takes place in LA and should be taken seriously.
So what happens now? Oh, sorry.
Well, the Banditos are at the East LA station specifically, where I don't think we ever talked about this. The East LA station was in the news because they had an old logo that...
Who is designing all these tattoos and logos? Like, this is what
this
I
one
was,
actually this does like, not have a skull. Instead of a skull... It's a boot with a riot helmet on top, like sitting on top of it. But most notably, it refers to the East LA station as Fort Apache, which is an over the top racist, just like assessment of like, there's the like Fort, like the idea is that they're surrounded by like savages, basically, is the suggestion. And it came out of the riots in East LA in like 1970. Basically.
Yeah. And this has been the Banditos, now under investigation by the FBI. That was a gang that we discussed pretty recently because it is the same deputy clique that Carl Karin Mondo Young, recently reinstated by Alex Villanueva, and even more recently said to be unfit to be holding a badge and gun by
an independent review board,
is a member of that gang. So so we'll keep tracking what's going on with that.
Yeah, what happens is like a year from now, like maybe they tell us what's going on. It doesn't seem that these things move that fast. Also, I want to highlight a Times article from earlier this month by Tony Barboza and Raul Mukherjee. It was smoggy this weekend.
It was real bad.
Saturday, it got into almost very unhealthy territory on the weather app instead of just unhealthy. And you could see it
Friday,
and
too.
Smell
Friday
it.
For a Friday few hours, bad. Too. And also on 4th of July, which no one ever talks about.
4th of July is the worst.
Fireworks are really bad.
Yeah, is the worst day to breathe. Or the 5th, actually. Like the day
it was
of the 5th.
Like, yeah, it was, like
really,
the,
really
it was like the night into the next day. Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
This article, the headline is "The War on Southern California Smog is Slipping. Fixing it is a $14 billion problem." Our number of bad air days are going up, like around the country, but especially in Los Angeles, where they were higher.
And we had Brian Lindblad on the show almost a year ago, feel like.
Something like that.
Maybe in the fall. But talking, kind of alerting us to the horrible summer that we had had. And I have a feeling we're going to beat that number again this summer.
We could. So for listeners, I would just go back and listen to that episode because nothing has changed in the intervening period. I think that's all we got for this week. Everyone, thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week on LA Podcast. Goodbye.
LA Podcast. LA Podcast. LA Podcast gonna have